You're listening to a podcast from the South China Morning Post.
Hong Kong is a very complex problem because we've given tremendous amounts of money in the form of incentives to make Hong Kong free, to make Hong Kong work. But all of those incentives, billions and billions and billions of dollars we gave to Hong Kong, I've taken back now because Hong Kong is, if you use a business term, it's owned by China. So why should I give this to China? Hong Kong can never succeed without those incentives, and Hong Kong can never succeed having China, as opposed to the thousands of geniuses that ran it, having China run it. The Hong Kong markets will go to hell. Nobody's going to do business. Very few people are going to do business in Hong Kong anymore. So we've taken it back, and we are going to make billions and billions of dollars more because
I can confirm it is swelteringly hot here in Hong Kong, but I don't think we're quite in hell just yet. Hello and welcome to the US-China Trade War Podcast with me, Finbar Birmingham, on the Political Economy Desk at the South China Morning Post. We continue to brave the heat and work from home in an effort to contain our third wave of coronavirus in this city, which of course, as you may have just heard, has been in the spotlight for other reasons of late as well. We've had sanctions on the chief executive Carrie Lam and other senior officials from the Hong Kong government and the mainland officials responsible for the city. Stories have emerged that Chinese banks are preparing for these sanctions, which could pose a huge risk to the financial sector in Hong Kong and mainland China. You're going to hear all about this from podcast stalwarts John Carter and Joe Shin in the first part of the show, as well as the renewed focus on China's mounting debt problems. Senior officials warned this week that there could be trillions of dollars of bad loans in the Chinese system. That is one problem on the plates of Chinese officials. Speaking of plates, we've just seen Xi Jinping announce a crackdown on food wastage in the world's most populous nation. We'll be hearing from the editors about the historical precedents today and whether it may be another spanner in the works for China's economic recovery. In the second half of the show, you will hear the podcast debut of Jake Fromer, an investigative reporter in our US Bureau, and we welcome back after a few weeks Sissy Zhou, my colleague here on the Political Economy Desk in Hong Kong. I had the pleasure to work with these two muckrakers on an investigative report over the last month into the surging sales of US farm equipment to the controversial Xinjiang region this year. We're going to take you behind the scenes on this report, which has started making waves on Jake's side of the pond. A lot to get through this week. Let's get on with the show.
Delighted to be joined today, as usual, by our political economy editors, John Carter, Joe Shin. We heard from President Donald Trump at the top of the podcast there. He said some interesting things overnight about Hong Kong, talked about how the United States has given billions of dollars to Hong Kong in incentives over the years, and it's now taking that back. We've had a listen to that just now. John, Joe Shin, what do we think President Trump is talking about here? What's he referring to in terms of these billions of dollars in incentives?
But for me, I think it doesn't make sense because if he was talking about the special trade status Hong Kong has joined, a separate treatment from mainland China, I think the commoditized trade in Hong Kong is very small because Hong Kong really don't have a large manufacturing business. You know, changing made in Hong Kong to made in China really doesn't make that huge differences in terms of billions and billions and billions of dollars. But I think the message Trump is trying to deliver is that, you know, Hong Kong as a financial center has been blessed sort of by the support from the United States. And without this kind of support, without the dollar system, you know, without the full free capital flows with U.S. institutions, with the dollar system, Hong Kong's future might be facing lots of uncertainties. I think to this extent, Trump's words, although lacked logic as usual, still has a point. And this is also the Chinese side is worrying about how can Hong Kong continue to develop if the United States no longer regards Hong Kong as a free or as a global financial center that it should be supported. Of course, Beijing's official line is that Hong Kong's prosperity is always backed on mainland China instead of on the United States far, far away. But as a matter of fact, we can see that the United States is still the number one in the global financial system. And as a financial center, you know, the Hong Kong dollar is pegged to the US dollar, and the market is activated by US institutions. So this is a very interesting thing to watch, you know, how's the future of Hong Kong as a financial center when the US is turning hostile to China and even to the city. You know, will Hong Kong really become the Berlin of the 21st century? It's no longer like a free market hub as it has enjoyed in the last couple of decades.
Indeed, the Berlin of the 21st century, quite a statement there. Joe Shin and John, you obviously have followed this very closely. And we had the AmCham report again this week, their monthly temperature check, as they call it, which shows that 40% of American firms in Hong Kong are thinking of moving their investments out of here, at least partially in the short to medium term. John, this is really does create an existential crisis for Hong Kong as a financial and business hub in this part of the world.
It does. I mean, the key question, as before, is do firms, foreign firms, and you need to look at it, not just U.S. firms, but firms around the globe, is Hong Kong is the gateway, or has been the gateway, for about 70% of investment going into mainland China. China is the second largest economy in the world and the largest consumer market in the world. And virtually every company of any size wants to do business there. And so will Hong Kong's status as the gateway to China's domestic economy be maintained in greater or lesser extent? We'll have to wait and see. The most recent moves, particularly the use of the national security law against democracy advocates, has left a lot of people cold and wondering whether China's promises to basically leave Hong Kong alone, except for the most egregious cases, will actually be true, and whether China will go after foreign firms at some point for some reason. And I would note for you that the national security law makes it illegal to comply with the sanctions of another country. So if an American bank, for instance, says, I can't do business with you anymore because you are sanctioned by the U.S. government, that is against the law in Hong Kong.
That's a really great point, John. And I would add to that point that there were some stories this week that Chinese banks are making plans to deal with the sanctions. I mean, since we last spoke, since last Friday, we've seen Carrie Lam, the chief executive of Hong Kong, slapped with sanctions by the United States, along with some very senior officials, both from Hong Kong and from the mainland Chinese body overseeing Hong Kong. So where does that leave the Chinese banks? I mean, that they want to trade and transact in U.S. dollars too.
Well, I have to assume that the Chinese bank, particularly the big state-owned banks, have a workaround at some point. They're not going to defy Beijing and say, we won't do business with these Chinese and Hong Kong officials. That doesn't make any sense. But they also want, at least for appearances' sake, they want to not aggravate relations with the United States, because, as you say, they want to do business in the United States. So how does this work out? I think we need more information.
I think it makes even a step further, because you know, for political reasons and for every other reasons, you know, Chinese banks have to answer to the Chinese government, especially the state-owned banks. They are controlled by the Chinese government, but if they want to operate in this kind of environment, they have to realistically think about the sanction risks from the United States. Because if a state-owned Chinese bank is sanctioned by the United States, what the Chinese government can do to help it is quite limited. Mm. So it's very reasonable, I think, for the Chinese state banks to prepare for these kind of risks, at least to manage it, you know, in the next couple of months, if really one of the Chinese state banks is named by the U.S. As violating the sanctions, then this bank's international business will be doomed. You know, apart from the banks, China has loads of experiences in dealing with U.S. financial sanctions. I often say in one good example is Zhuhai Zhenrong, which is a state-owned oil trader. You know, it's decided to go against the United States sanctions to trade with Iran. And at the end of the day, you know, its business just keep shrinking, because, you know, you really can't do business with any other clients apart from Iran. And then even if you rent a ship, or if you want to process your payments, you know, you buy an insurance policy for your vessels. You know, for instance, if your ship wants to go to Singapore, you need you need an insurance policy from an insurance company. And this insurance company will possibly, and not possibly, it's very likely, you know, is building the United US dollars. And if you don't get this this policy, and no one will sell you this insurance policy. And by that means, you know, you cannot go through the easiest maritime way to ship back the oils. We can see Zhuhai General used to be one of the, you know, major oil state-owned oil trading companies among, you know, China National Oil or PetroChina. But now its business is neglectable. It basically doesn't have any presence in any significance in China's oil trade anymore. So this is a clear lesson for all these Chinese state-owned companies or Chinese state-owned banks. You know, this is example. You know, you can try say, I don't care about the U.S. sanctions, but the reality is much harsher down the road if we really go down that road.
Yeah, absolutely, Joshin. Excellent points there. The dollar hegemony obviously is made clear, especially when you know, there's a lot of chat about China maybe coming off SWIFT or stopping to transact on SWIFT or creating or, you know, advocating its own alternative to SWIFT, which it launched a few years ago. But it seems a long way down the road, but they may have to escalate that now. But I wanted to ask you, Joshin, we had prominent speakers in China this week warn of some great risks to the economy. Yu Yongding, who is a former advisor to the People's Bank of China. When I speak to people in the US and in Europe, he is one of the Chinese commentators that they always look out for because they respect his analysis so much. He warned about the risk of financial sanctions overseas to the assets of Chinese banks. Subsequently, we had the chairman of the China Banking and Insurance Regulatory Commission, Guo Xuqing, warn about trillions of dollars of bad loans in the system. So you've got real problems there domestically in terms of the debt and the quality of the debt in China, but also challenges internationally in terms of the US and its actions against China. Joshin, this is a series of significant headwinds for policymakers. Which of these is the most concerning?
Well, I think both they are. You know, the U.S. sanctions can be viewed as black swan events. You know, these kind of unexpected things to happen, and the debt problem is China's gray rhino risk. You know, the risks are there, but you know, it's just difficult to get rid of it. So I think yes, you are right. I mean, for Beijing, it's really a challenging time. So if the external environment become more hostile, the domestic pressure will also build up. You know, in one way, you have to have this dual circulation. You have to boost the domestic investments, domestic consumption, and by doing so, you are feeding this the gray rhino of the debt risks. So you are kicking the can down the road. So for China, it's really a tough choice. As you said, these are the two major risks, and I don't think there are any really like silver bullets to solve them both.
There's black swans, there's grey rhinos, but there's no silver bullets. I got it. John, you've been following China's financial system for many years now. The debt problem that is there is not new, but how is it? Is it different today than it was maybe 10 years ago?
Well, it's just bigger. I mean, China took on a lot of debt after the global financial crisis. That led to a lot of unintended consequences in the economy, excess production capacity, and a lot of crazy projects that made no economic sense whatsoever. And China was gradually reducing their overall debt as part of a deleveraging campaign that started a number of years ago. But of course, that all turned around this year because of COVID. So now their debt is back up around 300% of GDP, which is quite large internationally. I would also note for you that China is the largest creditor country in the world. It's got a lot of loans out there to other countries, institutions, and it has had to give payment holidays to some and has written off some. But that is still a large risk if the global economy continues to underperform.
Joshin, you wrote this morning, or I think you wrote it yesterday, the story about China doubling the size of the railway network, the high-speed rail network, by 2035. Is this a sign as to, I mean, we've seen other signs, but is this perhaps the biggest sign yet as to how China sees its recovery path? It has gone back to this old playbook of stimulus, infrastructure and investment.
Yes, because the railway spending has always been an important part of China's state-led infrastructure investment. And as I quoted this outstanding economist, Larry Hu from Macquarie, he said, you know, China's growth basically has three pillars: exports, property, and infrastructure investments. Now, exports, apparently we cannot put hope on that. And the property speculation is not encouraged. So the infrastructure investment has become the only pillar that, you know, shall never fall down. Mm. So we can see that China is trying to do this. But in a longer term, and also, I think Beijing is putting hopes on this more extended railway system to, you know, to combine or to make China as a more efficient single market. You know, the fruits planted in Fujian can be easily shipped to Tibet, for instance, and whatever produced in Xinjiang can be more easily shipped to the coastal lines. These kind of social benefits, I think, Beijing is really looking at in terms of building this national railway network. And also, Shen Jingguang made a very the economist for JD.com has made a very good point, because he said, for now, it looks like China's domestic migration is changing. You know, it's no longer the story that people from Western or Central areas are flocking to coastal areas to take jobs. People now more prefer to take jobs in a city nearby, for instance, in Xi'an, in the Shanxi province, or in Lanzhou, in the Gansu. And so these kind of cities will become the regional hubs. So there is a reason for China to build up a nationwide railway system. And also connecting every city with at least 500,000 people into this system is also has a point, because by Chinese standard, of course, a city with 500,000 people is a very small place, is a nowhere. But for many like European or Australian places, you know, a town with 500,000 people is quite decent, quite big. Mm. Frankfurt was the economic heart of Germany when its population was just 500,000. So China was also trying to repeat his kind of success. Remember, we are talking about 2035. By that time, by President Xi's own definition, China would be quite moderately well off, possibly, you know, with per capita GDP, $15,000 and a high income country. So at that time, I think there will be sufficient demand or the spending power to support this kind of national system of railway.
Sure. I'm from Northern Ireland, capital city, Belfast, population 280,000, just to illustrate your point there, Joshin.
Okay, thank you.
We're speaking on Friday. We've had the data for the month of July come out this morning from the National Bureau of Statistics in Beijing. Really quickly on this, John, we've seen the economy grow, but maybe not as quickly as the analysts thought in July, and not as balanced as they would have liked either.
The big disappointment was that retail sales declined for the seventh month in a row. There'd been expectations that it would show in July the first increase this year. And this is one of Beijing's big hopes, is that the consumer spending will rebound and help drive the economy. Heretofore, the economy has been powered ahead by industrial production to support exports and to support the infrastructure spending. And industrial production was again up in July. But as I say, the consumer is continuing to lag, and this is worrisome for Beijing. And how do they get the consumer back on track?
Absolutely. We will see this in the coming months. The retail element will be particularly interesting. And just really quickly before we finish up, I'll ask Joe Shin about this. The food wastage drive from President Xi Jinping to cut down food wastage within China. I've been speaking to analysts all morning who are saying that, yes, this may actually have an impact on the economy because it will cut incomes at restaurants and so on. Tell us a bit, Joshin, about this plan and the historical precedents to it.
Yeah, this is quite extraordinary, because the president, the state leader, came out and telling people to be strict on food and to not waste the food, you know, clean your plates. This has found lots of talks. I think its implications is more social and kind of ideological more than financial economic. For restaurants, yes, they will be affected because it was serving small plates and also fewer dishes, maybe less banquets. and especially buffet restaurants, they may have trouble. And also for some video companies, you know, live blogging of eating shows has already been banned. So it's a very it's very interesting. This has been fanned lots of talks in China about whether the country is facing a kind of food shortage problem. Because the last time a Chinese state leader, national leader, coming out and telling people to pay attention to food is actually Chairman Mao did in 1959, you know, when the Great Famine in China was about to start. And the Chairman Mao basically told Chinese people, like, if you are engaged in hard labor, you know, you should eat more solid food. If you are leisure time, maybe having congee instead of rice. And also, you should have other supplements like potatoes and vegetables. So this kind of instruction is from President Xi is interesting. And also, he was trying to send a message that although, you know, China is going to be a comprehensive way of society, but China still has a long struggle against the United States, you know, in front of the country. So everyone should be prepared for this extravagant lifestyle or Western food. It's not something that will be encouraged or even tolerated. So this is also the message. And now I think most of the people get the message, like, okay, let's tighten our bets, you know, brace ourselves for the turbulence ahead.
Yeah, and the first question on everybody's mind is, does this spell the end of Hubei Pangzai, the viral Chinese food demolisher who was downing bottles of beer and eating all sorts of dishes, but he his 5 minutes of fame on the Chinese and global internet may be well and truly up with this.
Let's wait and see. Let's wait and see to see if we were banned or not.
Great stuff. That's excellent, guys. John Carter, Joe Shin, thanks as always.
Okay.
Thank you.
Just a quick update on the changes at the South China Morning Post's website, smp.com. You will know that these are very challenging times for media and news organizations around the world. Along with other outlets, we are changing our business model. At smp.com, you're going to get access to the first few articles for free, then you'll be asked to subscribe. This will not change your access to our podcast, but subscribing does make a big difference to ensuring our team at the Political Economy Desk, as well as colleagues around the Post, can continue to bring you high-quality journalism 24 hours a day.
More than 180 civil rights organisations from around the world are urging Western brands to stop sourcing cotton, textiles and garments from Xinjiang within 12 months.
We know what you're thinking. When's that remedy coming to stripper cotton? The answer is now.
And on the floor of the House of Representatives, on a bipartisan, bicameral legislation, we are here. We are here in support of the Uyghur Human Rights Policy Act, strong bipartisan legislation to address and defend the rights and dignity of the Uyghur people.
And it's all tied into the universal John Deere farm site strategy.
Chinese and foreign companies involved in these camps. And it engages the full firepower of American law and leadership, including by urging the application of targeted sanctions against those involved in the oppression of the Uyghur people.
Next part of the show, we're going to take you behind the scenes on a recent South China Morning Post investigation with my colleagues Jake and Sissy. We're going to be referring to a machine called a cotton picker in this, which I know does have some cultural and historical baggage, but we're referring to these enormous machines that harvest cotton in the fields and expanses of Xinjiang and in the American South. These things are massive. Imagine a garbage truck or a lorry plowing through a field and harvesting all the cotton in there. We enjoyed putting this investigation together, so I hope you enjoy this part of the show. We're going to talk now a little bit about a recent investigation we did here at the Post involving a few of our colleagues. The story was led by Jake Frommer, who is an investigative reporter in our Washington bureau. Jake worked with Sissy Joe, who does a lot of digging in our Hong Kong office, and in the pre-COVID days, she roamed around China and Vietnam picking up stories in those places too. This story is about US-China trade, but one very specific part of it. We talk a lot on the podcast about farm goods, things like soybeans and corn, but this one's about farm machinery. John Deere cotton picking machinery, to be more precise. And these hulking high-tech and super expensive machines are being sold to the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region. You may have heard of this. It is the Western Chinese region that is plagued by forced labor accusations, as well as widespread detention of Uyghur people and other Muslim minorities. I've got Jake and Sissy on the line. Jake's in Washington. Sissy is elsewhere in Hong Kong. And Jake, just to kick us off, I think the first thing that's worth establishing is, why is this an interesting story that sellers in the United States are shipping these expensive pieces of cotton machinery to buyers in Xinjiang? Because the US trades a lot of things with China, but why did this one in particular jump out at you?
You know, first of all, the U.S. does trade, as you said, a lot with China, but right now, anytime there's any trade that involves Xinjiang, it's going to raise some eyebrows here. The region is kind of at the center of a lot of pretty damning human rights allegations that have come from human rights groups, from industry groups, from governments, from the U.N. all around the world. And so, yeah, even if something isn't necessarily illegal there, it's certainly worth paying attention to, just because from what we hear, the rights abuses there run pretty deep in a lot of the industries and supply chains there.
Of course, Jake, there's also a lot of legislation ongoing and some of it already passed in the US to try and stop US businesses doing trade with Xinjiang or involving Xinjiang. Tell us a wee bit about that.
Sure. There is a bill that passed into law actually quite quickly. It was the Uyghur Human Rights Policy Act. And that, out of the 535 members of Congress, 100 senators, 435 members of the House, only one person voted against it. And that shows that there is very broad, very bipartisan interest across the entire political spectrum in this human rights issue. And it also comes in the context of rapidly deteriorating relations between the U.S. and China in the big picture. But this in particular is a real human rights concern to a lot of the Congress.
Yeah, this is a real, this cuts to the core of it, and it's bipartisan, as you said. So Jake, before I move on to Sissy, tell us, you were poring over customs data, having known you for just a few short months. I know this is something that you seem to do with great regularity. Tell us, how did you get the genesis for this idea and how did you take it forward?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a great way to pass the time during an extended quarantine in the middle of a pandemic. If you have a few thousand rows of customs data to sift through. I was scrolling through, and I was just looking basically for the reason I described earlier at US-China trade, where the items were marked as being directed toward Xinjiang, just because I was curious what kind of trade is even going on. You don't hear much about it. You hear a lot about China's exports out of Xinjiang, because there have been a lot of, again, human rights groups and industry groups that have raised the alarm about forced labor in the region, producing clothing that people are wearing all over the world and things like that, textiles. But I was curious, what is the U.S. selling to Xinjiang? And I saw in the data, I didn't really know what it was, but it was a huge number comparatively in terms of the total weight, the volume, the number, and the item was called cotton picker. That was the English translation in China's customs data. And I didn't know what it was, but that alone was something worth looking into.
It's a red flag for sure. Conversations we've had over months now with people involved in that sector, human rights advocates, NGOs, and labor rights people, the message we get on this is that anything that is involved in the cotton sector in Xinjiang is really inextricable from these forced labor allegations. So I think when Jake came to us in Hong Kong and said, I have found all of these cotton pickers being sold to Xinjiang from the US, we really took note, and we were very keen to get involved. And Sissy, at this point, you were brought into the story. you were making a lot of calls. You did a lot of digging. We found that there were a whole load of John Deere dealerships dotted around Xinjiang. Tell us about some of the people you spoke to in the region. We were amazed by some of the stuff you were hearing, and it really added to the story. Give us a few highlights.
So when you ask people about cotton in Xinjiang, they always mention XPCC, which is also called Bintuan in Chinese. It has played a key role in developing agriculture and infrastructure in Xinjiang. So XPCC has jurisdiction over 7 cities in Xinjiang, including Beitun and Shihezi, where there are multiple John Deere dealerships. One of the big John Deere dealerships I talked to is also based in Urumqi, actually. So before, cotton pickers were extensively used in Xinjiang. Students, for example, in Shihezi, which is actually controlled by XPCC, they were forced to pick cotton by hand during harvest season. And migrant workers from other provinces like Anhui and Henan would also be transported to Xinjiang to help pick the cotton. And for individual farmers, after they harvest cotton, most of them also sell the cotton to XPCC-affiliated cotton companies.
So, Sissy, when you were speaking to these people who were running the dealerships, what was their reaction when were they aware that the sanctions were coming in? Were they worried that they may be cut off from this vital US machinery? What was the general mood there?
The general mood there was a little bit nervous, but they don't really know what to do. For example, one of the dealers that I talked to, who is based in Urumqi, he said that he's pretty worried about the upcoming sanction, which might impact his future business, because he placed an order about 1 billion worth of John Deere cotton pickers last year, and all of them were shipped earlier this year. And then he is supposed to place a new order in December or November this year, but he is not sure whether he can still place the order. And another dealer that I talked to, so he is not that direct, because when I asked him, are you worried that your business will be impacted? He paused for a few seconds and then told me, I have imported a lot earlier this year, which can sustain for a long time.
And this was the color that really helped illustrate the customs data that Jake had been poring over for so long. We had seen huge spikes in shipments in April, May, and June of cotton picking machinery, cotton harvesting machinery from the United States to Xinjiang. Jake, I will bring you back in here. Look, the fact that all of this is being mechanized, some may say that maybe that is a way of getting rid of forced labor out of the supply chain. But from the research you did and the activists and academics you spoke to, I understand it's not really the case.
Yeah, there are two parts of it from what people told me. First of all, you have the farming side where everything from, it starts as a seed in the ground. And even before that, you have to prepare the ground to make sure it's suitable for planting. We think of, at least here in the US, when we think of cotton, we think of the South here, which can be, hot and humid. Xinjiang isn't always associated with that kind of weather. It's quite arid. So irrigation is really important. And people told me that, who's digging the irrigation ditches? Who's going out and, planting the seeds? Just because you're harvesting the cotton out of the ground with a machine doesn't mean there aren't other jobs. That's only half of it, though. The other half is what happens to the cotton after it's picked. Why are they bringing in all of this high-tech equipment? These machines, by the way, are the best machines in the world. If you ask any cotton farmer in the world, they'll tell you that these particular machines are the best ones to buy. Why do they need it, and why do they need it so efficiently? And there's a lot of concern among the industry that cotton in the region is being processed into textiles with forced labor. There are a number of steps once the cotton is picked. And so the supply chain, the different pieces of it aren't always separated out so simply.
This is impossible to separate is the message that we kept getting. You've just said there, Jake, about how this is the top of the range machinery, the most heralded cotton harvesting machinery there is. And it's also something which cuts right to the core of Americana. This is a really iconic brand. There are photographs and, transcripts of Donald Trump doing speeches at John Deere factories. Xi Jinping, when he went to Iowa in 2012, there's a photo of him on a John Deere tractor. So I think one of the things that stood out to me, Jake, is just how iconic this brand is. So, what's been the reaction to this story? Do you find that people have been shocked to learn that such a important American company has been engaging in such behavior?
Yeah, people have been quite taken aback by this. I think a lot of the stories we hear coming out of Xinjiang and involving Uyghur forced labor, they're not always so specific as to say, here is exactly the product that is being used. Here is the company that's supplying it. It's sometimes just saying we are broadly concerned that such and such Chinese subcontractor is doing these things, and all of the companies who contract with that company can say, well, we're not going to use them anymore, and then they can kind of slip away from those accusations. But here is indisputable evidence that we have from both the data, from American trade data, from Chinese trade data, and from talking to equipment merchants in both Xinjiang and the US, showing that these machines are going straight from the US to Xinjiang for the sole purpose of making their cotton production more efficient in that region.
Absolutely. And Sissy, when you spoke with the people in Xinjiang, is there a chance that they could just start using Chinese equipment instead of John Deere equipment? Is it the same, or is this just not in the same category?
No, they cannot compete. The Chinese made ones, they cannot compete with John Deere at all. So John Deere and Case are basically dominating the whole cotton picker market in Xinjiang, especially John Deere. So if you search cotton picker in Xinjiang, and the results pop up were always related to John Deere. And the individual farmers and also the dealers, all of them, they told me that the John Deere cotton picker are super efficient and they are impeccable. And I also asked them that if there's no way to use the U.S. imported machines, is it possible to use Chinese-made ones? Because, you know, there are also a few Chinese brands which are manufacturing cotton picker. And then they said it's not that the Chinese-made ones cannot replace the U.S. ones at all. It's just that efficiency is much lower, and there are always problem when you are using a Chinese-made ones in the field.
And I think we're going to have companies have got until the end of September to stop trading with XPCC or other sanctioned entities in Xinjiang. We shall see how that develops. We'll bring you more on that in further weeks of the podcast. But Jake Frommer, Sissy Joe, thank you so much and well done on your great work on this story.
Thanks.
Thanks, Fimba.
Thanks for listening to this week's US-China Trade War podcast. I have been Finbar Birmingham, as ever, on our political economy desk at the South China Morning Post. Please take a moment to like, share, subscribe to this podcast wherever you're listening. You can keep up to date on all stories related to what's been discussed today at scmp.com. We're at SCMP Economy on Twitter. We will be back as ever next week. Until then, stay safe, wash your hands, keep your distance, and please wear a mask. All the best.
For more podcasts from the South China Morning Post, head to scmp.com, where you can hear more about technology, trade, culture, and society.